who started walking purposefully toward the counter.
"Surprised you're buying here, instead of from your little friends," Mullen said, approaching Ben from behind. "Decent people don't take rides from Jawas."
"It won't replace shuttle service, that's true," Ben said. He didn't look up from folding and sorting his cloth goods on the counter. Annalene paused her own counting. "Be nice, Mullen."
"That's right. Remember, he's the big hero."
Vika strutted up to the counter beside Ben. She hoisted herself onto it, nearly knocking his neat stack of cloth goods onto the floor.
"Get off there!"
Annalene said, shoving at the young woman. Vika didn't budge. Ben slipped his folded purchases inside his new pillowcase. "It's all right," he said quietly. "It's just high spirits."
"Spirits is right,"
Annalene said, sniffing at Vika.
"And not even an hour past lunchtime. Well done."
She wished again that Danar had never decided to keep the bar open all day long.
A look at Mullen and Zed said they were similarly lubricated.
"Don't you people have vaporators to get back to?"
Mullen belched.
"Our machines, our schedule."
"I don't think your father would agree with you," Annalene said. Mullen knelt by the wash basin at Ben's feet.
"That's a lot of junk he's buying. Is his money good?"
Mullen grabbed the handle of the tub with one hand and slid it closer. If Ben took offense or even noticed as the dark-haired man pawed through his purchases, Annalene didn't see.
"I wouldn't trust him,"
Mullen finally pronounced. Annalene slammed her data pad on the counter.
"That's enough, all of you!"
"Last I checked, Mullen Galt, your name wasn't on the deed. Or anything else. Except maybe that arrest warrant in Mos Entha. Why don't you go back there?" she said.
Vika sidled closer to Ben, reached out and put her thumb underneath his chin.
"He's a nice one,"
she said, tilting his face upward like livestock under study.
"Looks hungry, though."
"Another grubber starving on the range."
Mullen looked up from where he crouched, to Ben's left.
"He wasn't saving Callie. He probably wanted the dew bag for a meal."
Behind, Zed guffawed. Vika gripped Ben's hairy chin between her thumb and forefinger.
"I don't know. I'd be fine with him saving me."
She lifted his face toward hers and leered at him.
"How about it, Benny? You want to save a grown-up for a change?"
"Fine," Ben said politely. "Do tell me when one comes in." Annalene laughed loudly. At the sound of laughter at Vika's expense, Zed surged forward. Like half the gaunt farmhands, the bruiser thought the boss's daughter lit the stars in the sky. With Mullen still at Ben's feet with the tub, Zed grabbed at the shopper's shoulder in righteous indignation. That was when it began. Callie entered through from the livery yard to the right of the group. She carried the Bantha prot from the Jabe incident, the latest in a series of items she was returning to the tack room in her ongoing effort to see Ben. She saw her dashing hero all right, standing uneasily with Vika perched lasciviously on the counter with a leg on either side of him. Stunned, infuriated, and long possessed of the view that the wrong Galt twin had died years earlier, Callie raised the Bantha prod. Seeing the hate in Callie's eyes, Annalene hurriedly grabbed Vika's collar. As her mother attempted to pull the young woman back from danger, Callie snapped the prod in the direction of Vika's dangling right foot. The next second passed quickly. Annalene saw Ben turn to avoid the prod, raising his right hand ever so slightly.
It was at that moment that the prod, which had a patented never-slip grip, flew from Callie's hand. Its electrified tip glanced harmlessly against the counter, missing Vika's boot, and somehow also Ben's torso.
He turned 90 degrees as the implement fell past his knees to where it finally came to rest, planted vertically
into the metal tub that held the rest of Ben's shopping. A metal tub still being held by the hand of Mullen Gault. With a crackling discharge, the device expended its entire energy supply in one tumultuous flash. Mullen screeched louder than the settler's call siren had ever sounded. Startled, Vika fell backward into Annalene. The sudden weight of Vika knocked her feet out from under her, and the two landed in a tangle on the floor behind the counter. Annalene scrambled to extricate herself and rise. The first thing she saw across the counter was Zed, looking stupidly down at Mullen, writhing in agony on the floor. Snarling, Zed charged Ben. The older, smaller man stepped lithely out of the way, sending the lumbering Zed into a display of cans of whitewash. The collision wasn't as loud as Mullen's scream, but it was quite a bit messier. Without a word, Ben turned, bowed slightly to Annalene and Callie, the only other still standing, and slapped a pile of credits on the counter. He grabbed the loaded pillowcase and fled through the door to the livery yard. Bewildered, Annalene hopped onto the counter and jumped to the other side, her boots just missing the writhing, weeping Mullen. Ben's tub of purchases was still there, abandoned. She ran to the doorway, where Callie was calling out after him. But more chaos waited outside. Mullen's electric screech seconds earlier had evidently placed the Jawas under the impression that a Logra, a burrowing predator with a taste for the short merchants, had surfaced inside the store. Now they were ending all transactions and moving their goods back into the sandcrawler to the frantic yells of dissatisfied customers. Two unrelated brawls had broken out. And beyond, past the revving sandcrawler, Ben and Rue rode off toward the desert. Flummoxed, Annalene started to follow to alert him to his forgotten goods. But Herbalee Napti confronted her in the doorway first.
"The little glow-eyed man told me to come talk to you," the Nikto woman said. "Do you work here?"
Chapter 10. Oren sputtered at the comlink.
"I told you not to call me with this garbage."
He tilted his head back toward his landspeeder, trying to make the glance casual. The old man hadn't overheard him. While Ulbrich was still inside the USV-5, enjoying the blast of the air conditioning, Oren doubted that the old skinflint enjoyed anything except counting his money, but that wasn't important. He hadn't come to the farmer's rescue out of friendship or even benevolence. This was a sales call, and Vika had just interrupted it with a strange, disconnected story of chaos in the claim, damage to the store and his son, and some nonsense about Callie's hero.
"I don't care who did what,"
he said into the device, aggravated. The last thing he needed was trouble with Annalene. Once, she had barred the entire Gault employee base from dining at the claim. After a week of lunchbox living, Oren had a mutiny on his hands. There was only one response. "You'll clean up the store, apologize to Annie, and then get out here and finish your shift." He deactivated the comlink. Standing in the suns, Oren looked back at the old man in the landspeeder and smiled weakly. Ulbrich still wasn't paying him any mind. The old man had more hair in his face than his head, and yes, Ulbrich was using Oren's comb to straighten his beard. Lovely, Oren thought, closing the bonnet on Ulbrich's stalled repulsor truck. The battered ST-101 would be able to make it to the claim using the coolant Oren had brought. Now he had to make the favor pay off. "You're ready, Master Ulbrich," Oren said, opening the passenger side door to his landspeeder. "Sorry about the delay. I had to take a call." The old man grunted. Oren gave a rumpled smile. "It was just trouble at home.
Do you, plan on having children a while?
I'm 75. Take my advice, Orin said, grimacing.
Don't. It's safer that way.
He offered his hand to help Ulbrich stand up, but the old man ignored it. Ulbrich was still in good shape for his age. He had recently sworn off liquor, after some event Orin knew little about. But Orin attributed Ulbrich's condition more to his having delegated most of the work on his sprawling ranch to an army of farmhands in recent years, instead of toiling in the hot suns himself. Spreading to the south and east of Orin's holdings, Ulbrich's property was more than twice the size. And Orin doubted the man had visited a single one of his vaporators in a decade. It hadn't hurt their production at all. Ulbrich was rolling in wealth he never spent. All the more reason to protect it.
Speaking of safety, Orin said, conscious of the awkward transition, I was wondering if you'd thought about joining the Settlers' Call Fund.
Here we go again, Ulbrich said, derision evident in his gravelly voice. Knew that coolant wasn't free.
He threw Orin's comb back inside the landspeeder. I'm not trying to sell you anything. The fund helps the community protect people. Farmers, just like you.
I got my own security.
Ulbrich tromped across the sand toward his vehicle.
I don't need to be paying for your people to sit around getting soused.
They're not mine, Orin said.
The fund belongs to the whole Oasis community. I just administer it. He closed the passenger door to his landspeeder and followed Ulbrich.
Look, you run a business and you expect results. So do I. I respect that. If you want results, just look at the other day and what happened at the Bazaard place.
I saw you didn't save half of them.
Orin stepped back. That's not fair, Weil. Those people died before the call was activated. But the farmer and his wife and child, though, we saved those people.
He tried a different tack. Look, yours is the largest spread around here, not part of the fund. If you came in, we'd be able to upgrade our equipment. Maybe even put out some patrols to cover your place as well as some others. Proactive-like.
The old farmer stopped at the open door to his repulsor truck and turned his head. Orin stepped forward, expectantly, only to see the old man spit on the sand.
Not interested in anywhere else, Ulbrich said. My people watch my place. If Plug Eye comes around, you'll see a Tuscan dance.
Ulbrich climbed up into the cab of the tall vehicle. As he started the engines, he looked down at Orin, almost as an afterthought.
Thanks for the coolant.
Orin shook his head. Some people you just couldn't help.
The repulsor truck gone, Orin kicked the empty coolant container across the sand. He'd made most reluctant farmers come around one way or another. Not Ulbrich. The old man knew the fund based its fee on the amount of land to be protected. Ulbrich balked at paying more than anyone else on pure principle.
Well, he'll figure it out. One day, Orin thought.
There were more potential members to sign up. He'd need to check his map. He opened the door to his land speeder, its engine still running as it pumped out frigid air. He slipped into the driver's seat, only to find the oily comb underneath his backside. Blanching, Orin chucked it out the window and saw the pair of figures topping a dune to the northeast approaching him. Finding his electrobinoculars, Orin studied the sight.
Well, what do you know? He said aloud.
One chance lost, another found. He put the hovercraft into motion. The USV-5 coasted to a stop just short of the new arrivals. As caravans went, Orin thought it pretty meager. A hooded man walking alongside a heavily laden Eope. Neither reacted as Orin triggered the landspeeder's open-topped mode. Oren smiled.
Hello there.
Greetings.
That's a big load you've got.
The sandy-haired nomad eyed him warily. It's mine, if that's what you're wondering. I've come from the store.
Oren chuckled. I know. You don't have the wardrobe for a Tusken.
The farmer deactivated the engine and climbed out.
I'm Oren Galt. This is my land here.
My apologies, the traveler said, looking back at the horizon. Is it possible to get to the Calwell store without crossing the Galt land?
Not really, no. Oren grinned. He offered his hand.
I think I know who you are. You're that Ben I've heard so much about.
Ben took Oren's hand and shook it tentatively.
Heard about me?
From Cali Calwell.
The Calwells and the Galts. We're close.
And I owe you a debt of thanks. Sounds like you saved her from herself.
Ben lowered his eyes.
I think Cali embellished some. I was passing through and lent a hand. Anyone else would do the same.
Oren liked the sound of that.
Quite right.
But still, let me get you a drink.
He turned back to the landspeeder.
We're a ways from a cantina, Ben said, puzzled.
But not from the canteen.
Oren produced a gleaming silver flask and offered it to Ben.
Enjoy.
Ben nodded and opened the vial.
He drank and did an immediate double take. Gasping, he mouthed, Wow.
And that's lukewarm, Oren said, smiling broadly. He slapped the windshield of the landspeeder. I know you're on your way somewhere, Ben, but the least I can do is show you around. For a new neighbor.
Ben looked up, cautious.
How do you know I'm a neighbor?
Oren laughed.
Something about wearing hoods made half the newcomers on Tatooine think they were on a secret mission.
I doubt you're making supply runs for the Jawas. They went the other direction, anyway.
He gestured toward the landspeeder.
Come on. Just for a few minutes. You trespass, you get the guided tour. You might say, it's the penalty.
Chapter 11.
The USV-5 rocketed across the dunes. Hill after hill bristled with shining new vaporators, metal stalagmites stabbing into the sky. Ben sat quietly in the passenger seat, taking it in. He'd resisted the tour at first, but Oren had brought out an emergency canvas shelter from the landspeeder, and within moments the Yopi was inside, munching on the feed it had been carrying. Oren watched Ben out of the corner of his eye as he drove. The man seemed quiet, and thankfully unmarked by whatever had happened at the claim. Oren felt bad about that. The Oasis regulars, his kids included, could be rough on newcomers.
I'll tell you, Oren said again. I'm sorry about whatever happened back in the claim. When my kid called, I knew in a second who was to blame.
You got any little ones, Ben?
Just the EOP, Ben said.
The farmer laughed.
I'll tell you, if kids were as teachable as EOPs, this hair would still be black. Annalene's or something too, but you already saw that with Callie.
Energetic,
Ben allowed.
And all trouble.
Ben looked at him.
But worth it?
Don't put words in my mouth,
Oren said, feigning seriousness, before breaking out into laughter again.
No, most days I work out here with Mullen and Vika, and sometimes Jabe, Annalene's boy. You met him?
At the Sandcrawler,
Ben said simply.
Lot to keep track of, I know. Sometimes it's hard for me to tell where Annie's family stops and mine begins.
He elaborated briefly on his friendship with Danar and how Annalene had been running the shop since Danar's death.
That Annalene. She's a tower of power.
Ben nodded and returned to idly staring out the window. Oren smirked.
If Ben were interested in Annalene, that should have registered a response. But he seemed detached, or at least respectful of Orin's territory. Which was silly, of course. Orin and Annalene had never been like that, or at least she'd never been like that with him. Orin was married when Danar hired Annalene. By the time Orin's union started going wrong, the Calwells were married themselves, with Callie on the way. Orin wondered sometimes what would have happened if Lizelle had taken off earlier. But no, the Pika Oasis wouldn't be what it was today if he and Danar had been romantic rivals. Ben broke the silence. How did Danar Calwell die? It was a puzzling turn, Orin thought. I'll get to that, he said, applying the brakes. We're here. The landspeeder came to rest atop a hill, overlooking a wide expanse, empty but for vaporators as far as the eye could see. The men disembarked and studied the scene. Some devices were clustered together, others separated by hundreds of meters. Pretty, isn't it?
Unusual patterns. The way they're placed, it's almost...
an art? Not far from it, Orin said. This is field number 7. But I call it the Symphony. He pointed toward the nearest vaporator, halfway up the rise they were standing on. Follow me. At the device, Orin turned a key in a lock, opening a small door on the vaporator. Inside sat a vial, sealed beneath a tap. Orin removed it. You're the guest, Ben. You do the honors. Ben took the vial and examined it. Orin nodded. Go ahead, it's what you had a while ago. Ben raised it to his lips and drank thirstily. A split second later, his face showed that had been a mistake.
It's freezing.
It's this new Pretorman vaporator model. Comes off the compressors like that, Orin said, taking the vial back. But have you ever tasted sweeter water in your life?
I'll let you know when my tongue thaws out, Ben said, shaking his head to clear it. The vial wasn't that cold. Things aren't always what they seem.
Orin sealed the door on the vaporator and gestured to the horizon. See, Ben, it's taken me 6 years, but we finally brought Tatooine into the new era. All those towers I started with eons ago, they're gone. Rubbish for Jawas. These Pretormans are going to change this world, and the Oasis will be at the center of it. Ben squinted up at the tower.
I admit I never really understood. I thought water was the simplest thing in the universe to produce.
Maybe in the universe, Warren said, but not on Tatooine. Lots of reasons. Fuel cells make water, but they also make heat, something we've got enough of. That's just for starters. Ben listened, interested.
And you're too remote to ship anything in.
Right, but who'd want to? Orin walked back to the top of the rise. You see, that's the secret to this dead old planet. She's hiding her water. But what she's got is the tastiest anyone's ever had.
It's so good I could see Tatooine being a net exporter of water.
If we can just get at it.
His voice grew solemn. And I can.
He traced his hands in the air, connecting the dots that were the faraway towers.
Those little drops can run, but they can't hide.
These machines in the right place, tuned the right way, they need that sky like clay. They play the notes, and the music comes.
The symphony, Ben said respectfully.
Orin nodded. A lot of pieces have to work together at once. We're still working at it.
I'm impressed.
Ben wasn't a farmer or anything else as far as Orin had been able to learn, but he seemed to have a feel for what Orin was trying to do. Maybe, if he turned out to have a skill, he could even be a decent farmhand once Orin started hiring again. Orin returned to the landspeeder, suddenly weary. Farming, he loved. The rest of his life was just necessary. But he wasn't out today to farm. So first things first.
You asked about Danar. he said gravely. The Tuscans killed him 8 years ago. He stopped to help a rider in the desert, like you did with Callie. Tuscans killed them both.
I'm sorry, Ben said.
Well, it's been a while, Oren said. He turned back toward the younger man. Annalene said you were riding in from the east the other day. I don't guess you've ever heard of the Lars family. Ben cleared his throat.
The Lars, you say?
Klieg Lars. Everyone heard about it. Oren pointed to the east. Moisture Farm are over on the other side of Jawa Heights. If you're new, you wouldn't know. The Tuscans, same band that got Danar, I've always thought, kidnapped Klieg's wife. Ben started to say something, but stopped. Oren continued. Anyway, folks over there mounted a rescue mission. A bunch of farmers that didn't know one end of a rifle from another. They didn't have experience chasing Tuscans. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't have vehicles conditioned for more than a trip to check the vaporators.
It went badly.
Son, that's the understatement of the year. 30 went out. 4 came back. Oren remembered that horrible day and the days that had followed. Several victims had been longtime acquaintances. A lot of moisture farming wisdom had died at once. 26 gone, he said. Oren went silent to let the man take it in. Ben was troubled by the story, he could tell. It helped to paint a picture for people sometimes, and the Lars experience was as close to a worst-case scenario as it got. Oren had never met Klieg. He'd heard the poor soul was dead now. But his tale of torment almost always had an impact. Ben looked up from the ground.
And what happened next?
Funerals, mostly. Oren didn't add that he'd picked up a few tracts of land from the estates. Someone had to work them. He leaned on the hood of the floating landspeeder. Funerals and recriminations. You see, those people didn't have what we've got in the Oasis. The call. Oren quickly explained the settler's call system. Ben listened intently, noting that he'd heard the alarm echoing over the desert once before. Oren grinned, pausing to take credit for the crate dragon idea. Nothing sends a chill through their bandages like a crate yowl. He continued the sales pitch, well practiced by now. If the Lars raid had happened here, things would have gone a lot differently. A posse is a business. It's people coming together for a goal. You've got to invest and prepare. And when the call comes, he said, pointing to one of the vaporator towers, you know you've got a chance. Ben noticed the siren mounted atop the machine. He seemed impressed.
So it's a militia then?
Nothing like that. Oh, sure, there's a militia out of Mos Eisley, 3 or 4 full-timers, all afraid of their shadows. They never range this far out. Anyone with a mind for that kind of fighting would have headed off-world and made better money at it. This thing, it's just the people. They're not in it for the money. They just want to help. Ben nodded. Oren coasted into his wrap-up.
We respond. We rescue. And if we can't make a defense in time, it's our policy that every attack on a household rates a counterstrike. It's what the Tuscans understand, and it works.
Ben looked to the east.
How far out do you cover?
As far as our subscribers live, Oren said. He walked to the side of the vehicle. I've got a map here. Ben walked toward the vehicle.
As far as where, what did you call them, the Lars family lived?
No. But anything's possible if we get enough people on board, Oren replied as they both climbed into the speeder. But I thought you and Eriope were headed southwest. Ben shook his head and studied the map.
Just curious.
The Eriope was sleeping beneath the canvas when Oren returned with Ben. Oren was sure he'd gotten Ben's interest in the settler's call, but he hadn't coaxed much information out of him. Ben had a place against the northern outcrops of the western Jundland wastes.
and he'd come from somewhere else, probably the Republic. The Republic had never really paid much attention to Tatooine, and locals here usually responded in kind. Orin had heard something about a big change that had recently taken place in the Republic, but Ben seemed to know less about it than he did. Ben had asked him for news, in fact. But while Orin still didn't know what Ben did for money, he was confident that he had some. Otherwise, Anna Lean wouldn't have sold him all the goods the Eopi was carrying. Her gratitude seldom went that far.
"So," Orin said, watching the man repack the beast, "you want to sign up with the fund? You don't have to fight with the posses. Your credits pay for them to do it."
Ben finished tightening the load and looked at him.
"I don't know yet. I'm still getting settled in."
"Understood. But that's more reason to join. One less thing to worry about."
"You'll have to let me get back to you. I'm still not sure." Ben paused, seeming to hear something far away.
Orin followed Ben's gaze to the hills, but couldn't hear anything for several seconds. Then he heard and saw the familiar whir of his daughter Selenikio's Sportster landspeeder, heading toward them from the oasis.
"Good ear," Orin said. "That'd be Mullen and Vika. I guess they're dried out and ready to get back to work."
Ben looked warily in that direction and turned to take the Eopi by the bit.
"I'd better go. Our first meeting didn't end well."
The Eopi started to trot, and Ben jogged along with it. He passed Orin, who leaned against his landspeeder, frustrated. Now his kids decided to get back to work. Terrific.
"Listen, remember the offer," Orin said. "The price I cited during our ride is good only while the subscription drive is on. It goes up next week."
"I'll consider it," Ben said, waving behind him. "And thanks for the drink."
"Sure you won't? No, I must be on my way. Far to go and all." "All right, Ben. But come back around when you decide."
"I will."
Orin's shoulders slumped. 0 for 2 today. And 2 more troubles had arrived and were walking up to him. Vika looked her usual self for this afternoon hour. But Mullen had a frazzled appearance that gave him pause. What had his son gotten into at the claim?
"Where's Zed?" Orin asked.
"Hurt again,"
Mullen said, glaring at the figures departing to the southwest.
"Was that him?"
"Who?"
Orin looked in the same direction.
"You mean the guy with no job and no past, heading into the middle of nowhere like someone with no sense? That's Ben, all right."
He glared at his daughter.
"You marry a man like that, and I'll feed you to a sarlacc. Now get to work.
I'm behind schedule already."
Meditation. Today was interesting. I took a chance and went to the Peak Oasis. Danos Claim, the big compound up there. They have just about everything I need, except maybe an army to free the Republic. But I didn't stay. That's part of the problem. There are too many people there, but not quite enough either. The bigger places, like Mos Eisley, I can lose myself in. So many travelers come in and out. This place is busy too, but the oasis also has a lot of regulars who do nothing but watch the comings and goings all day. My arrival was, I'm ashamed to say, something of a spectacle. And, my departure too. I can't let that happen again. I also met one of the big landowners on the way out. Orin Gault, something of a local institution. I was reluctant to talk to him too long, and I tried to say nothing of substance, but he's nice enough, and I sense that he feels better if he knows everyone who's around. Trying to hide from a man like him might not be wise. He seems to mean well. And this settler's call system of his could be the answer to my problems keeping an eye on the Lars family, if their service could be extended that far to the east. I know it would be better not to involve them. But if Anakin's mother was taken, it could happen again. I'm here to protect the child. When it comes to the Tuskens, the locals' help might come in handy. It's a threat they're familiar with. I had a brush with the Sand People years earlier when you and I brought Padme here. They're formidable warriors. If something happens such that I can't continue my watch... Well, let's not think about that. But it's nice to have options. Orin, again, he's very much a hail fellow well met. I like him. Quite the salesman, to be sure. And while he's obviously very proud of what he's built out here, he also seems a little self-conscious about it. Enough so that he tries to put on an air of humility. Even if it's just a sales ploy, I think it's a little endearing. Anakin could have used a bit of that. We were all impressed with what he could do. But he was impressed too. And not in the least thankful for it. No. Not near the end. I have his lightsaber, you know. It's right here, sitting in my hands. Some nights, like this, I just sit and stare at it, wondering what I could have done to help him. I look, and I look, for answers. Then I put it away in the trunk and try to forget. It's impossible, of course. Maybe if he'd grown older, had been able to grow older, he'd have gotten some perspective. But that just wasn't to be. If only he'd listened to reason, hadn't forced me to do what I had to do, then I wouldn't be here now feeling like a... No. Good night, Qui-Gon.
Part 2. The Killing Ground. Chapter 12.
A large hovercraft left the compound heading to the east. There was a dark-haired human male driving it, not much more than a youngling. Ayark had seen this one before, and kept silent count as the vehicle made for the horizon. Once it had left, Ayark slipped back behind the dune and brought out the black rock. A smudged mark was made on the wrappings of the warrior's left arm, while another was rubbed off the tally on the right arm. Too many marks remained there, each one representing a settler present in the Oasis compound. Dozens arrived before the suns rose each morning, and the place remained in motion until well after night fell. Keeping count had tested Ayark's wits, and the total didn't even include the people who lived in the buildings. Only one of them mattered, of course. Ayark checked the stock of the blaster rifle where more counting could be found. 10 whittled notches. 10 days since the raid on the human farm had gone wrong. 10 days since the human woman had avoided death by dewback by mystical means. The Sand People, hearing Ayark tell of her, had chosen to call her Enagrash, the Air Shaper. Ayark had not had to convince them of what her existence meant. Settlers so empowered would threaten them all. Ayark had known one person to have such powers. Another Tuscan, long since dead. That raider had come to join the Sand People willingly. An exceptionally rare thing. And had survived the welcome and trials that followed, which was almost unheard of. That warrior had the ability to shape the air, too, a fact that had certainly helped during the initiation. But that recruit had ultimately proved mortal, and that gave Ayark hope now. It meant an air shaper could die. This woman must, before she taught her skills to the other settlers. Ayark had found the air shaper's home easily. She'd made no efforts to conceal the path of her surviving dewback. Settlers might have found tracking difficult on the rocky ground between the pitted area and the oasis, but they were not Tuskens. Ayark had crept up to the compound for a simple reconnaissance, only to realize the scope of the challenge. It was more than the sheer number of arrivals and departures. This place was the fortress of the Smiling One. It had to be. The war leader recognized from afar the vehicles the settlers had used in the defense of the farm. These and many more were stored in the huge garages. How large an army did the Smiling One have? Ayark hesitated to find out.
Ayark had also seen the fuzzy-faced Eopi rider from earlier, but only once, 7 days ago, departing the compound quickly with his mount. The human's presence had been puzzling, as Ayark had never seen him arrive. He had to have traveled with the Jawas.
That fact alone was offensive.
Jawas were no better than the parasites the Sand People plucked off their banthas. They were the children of the Coward Sun, to be sure.
The Eopi rider even dressed like one of them in his brown robe.
Perhaps Hairy Face, that seemed a good name for the man, was a shaman to the Jawas, able to command the chattering things.
The watchful raider had thought to follow the man as he journeyed toward the wastes. But the air-shaper had appeared in the yard, calling vainly after Hairy Face, alongside her foolish, dewback-riding child. Ayark had realized something else that day. The air-shaper also had a son. He was the one who had just driven away in the repulsor craft. The boy wasn't much older than Ayark's own son. Young Adin was back with the others today, going through the rites of adulthood. Ayark didn't want to be there. It would mean seeing what had become of the ritual.
By tradition, the tested youth was to have hunted and killed a crate dragon, but crates were few in the pillars where the tribe hid, and so were eligible Tuscan youths. So the elders had decreed that some other creature might suffice, such as a logra. Still dangerous, but nothing like a crate.
Ayark thought the choice was cowardly and had said so.
It described a clan so weakened that it could no longer keep to its principles. If a dean fell to a crate, fine. The child would have been adjudged a weakling and would have deserved death. It didn't matter that the boy was the last of Ayark's children. The warrior would have taken a blade to a dean personally, rather than see him live as a failure. But no one would know a dean's worthiness now.
They would be killing womp rats next and pretending it was bravery. More movement at the garages. The Smiling One was out there again, babbling to the freakish thing that tended the vehicles. Ayark kept watching the place. This was it, the center of all the Tuscans' problems. The air-shaper had shown Ayark the way. And soon, Ayark would lead the rest of the Sand People to her.
Keep going, I'm listening.
Annalene wasn't listening, but it hardly mattered. While Ulbrich spent far more money at the store than any other visitor to the Peak Oasis, and far more time, too. Ulbrich had a platoon of farmhands to run his spread. He knew in his heart that droids were thieves, programmed by Jawas to steal from their masters. The old moisture farmer had first pontificated on that subject when Annalene was running the counter at 17. 20 years later, he was still talking about it, among countless other topics. At the moment, Ulbrich was on another classic. The four times he had seen rain.
"And the second drop was right in my eye, let me tell you. I felt it, and I was looking up, too. You'd think rain would be like the mist some see on the ground, steaming up. But no, it comes right down at you, just like it fell out of a freighter."
"Uh-huh. Right." Annalene nodded as she dusted the merchandise on the shelves behind the counter. Ulbrich's ramblings were like recordings of familiar songs, arranged in a different medley each day. Because while the old farmer remembered a lot, he often forgot his place. An engineer who visited the Dune Sea years earlier once described Ulbrich's stories as transcendental loops defying the laws of physics and storytelling. She didn't know about that,
but she did suspect the cause of her pain. Ulbricht's wife, Magda. Annalene had never seen the woman. But it was clear she dispatched her husband to the store at the crack of dawn every morning to torment someone else for a change. This made Magda both a wise woman in Annalene's ledger and deserving of a smack in the face should they ever meet. But you know, I swear I seen a freighter take off once and go right through a flock of Nibre, and the things just hit the ground like sacks of spanners. Which is why I don't go near that Mos Eisley no more. 'Cause they're always trying to kill people and take their money.
Uh-huh, right. Annalene looked around, plaintively, for different company. It was futile.
The breakfast rush was over. The workers would be in the vaporator fields for hours. The Bizards had left her guest quarters early that morning to return home, anxious to pick up the pieces of their lives. The settlers around the oasis were resilient, as they had to be. Annalene didn't miss the extra burden, but she did miss the baby. Her babies were at work.
Jabe had taken the store's light van speeder truck to the dry goods distribution center in Bastine.
Callie was out back with the animals. That left her alone with Bomer, the slow-motion Rodian sitting at the luncheonette table considering his calf. She wondered what he saw there sometimes. She slouched against the cabinets and sighed.
"Find what you need at Danar's claim," the sign outside read.
What she needed was a month away on a lush green forest planet.
But back then, the first time I was working for real money on a vaporator, I just started crossing circuits. Beginner's luck, they called it. That was the second time I seen rain. Or maybe it was the first. I spent the rest of my days trying to figure out just what I did.
Annalene looked up. Orin entered through the back of the store, whistling and wearing the natty dress brown she'd picked out for him from the high-end catalog. Clicking his leather boots together, he smiled broadly at her.
How do I look?
Like you just landed from Coruscant, she said, smiling wanly back.
Thanks to my fashion coordinator.
Orin's expression hardened when he glanced at Ulbricht. Realizing the old man was in mid-rainfall, Orin rolled his eyes and plunked down his satchel.
Got a meeting in Mos Eisley. That new hotel is taking bids for a water supplier.
Annalene nodded. Since the last commodity bust, Orin had redoubled his efforts to lock in regular purchasers at preset prices.
I'll talk to a couple of farms on the way back about joining the settlers' call. Folks who actually care about protecting their assets.
Orin shot a pointed look at Ulbricht, but the old man paid him no mind. Annalene knew that Orin had tried again and failed again to sign Ulbricht up a week earlier. Turning his attention to the counter space, Orin patted his vest pockets.
Blast!
Forgot your credit pouch again? Annalene knew this story, too. Orin raised the hinged section of the counter and stepped to the cash box, sealed, as it had been in her husband's day, with the barrel of a blaster pistol inserted into a pair of metal rings. Annalene watched as Orin removed the blaster and pulled out a handful of credits. He looked at her abruptly.
Oh, I'll leave a...
Forget it.
Money in one hand, he placed the other on her cheek and smirked.
Thanks, Annie. Nobody loves me like you do.
You're probably right.
She watched the man leave.
Nobody had ever kept accounts between the two families when it came to the small things. But lately, Annalene had increasingly gotten the sense that whatever she owed Orin for protection and helping to rear her son paled next to the meals, supplies, and petty cash he'd taken out of the store. Still, a sunny nature counted for a lot, and if she wasn't going to begrudge while Ulbricht his audience, it was hard to refuse Orin his little liberties, especially now that he was in his big business phase. Drunk divorcee Orin had been a trial years before. The new model verged on blowhard,
especially now, as he seemed to be selling in overdrive lately. But that was a definite improvement. Ulbrich plopped down a bottle of fizz and a credit on the counter.
Say, did I tell you about the first time I saw a crate dragon?
Enough. Annalene's eyes scanned beneath the side counter. There it was. The tub of goods Ben had left behind the week before. She'd gone back and forth for days about restocking the shelves with the material. Now, opening the window behind her, she decided to do something else.
Callie!
Annalene leaned out the window. Her daughter was behind the store, in the livestock yard.
Callie, can you hear me? No. Can you watch the counter for a couple of hours? No. Great. Come on in.
Annalene shut the window and pulled the tub from beneath the counter. She was looking in the little mirror behind the kitchen door when Callie appeared from the back, a sodden, sullen mess. Annalene threw her daughter a rag. Clean up. I need you to work the till.
Do I have to?
Callie glared at her mother. You have something better to do?
I'm mucking out the dewback pen.
The girl peered in at Ulbrich, who was now nattering away to the hapless Rodian.
So the answer is yes. Sorry, sweetie.
Annalene stepped out from behind the door. Her hair was pulled back in a bun, and she was wearing her light cloak and hood.
I need to run to Arndt Thout to see a man about some dricklefruit.
Dricklefruit my eye? I know where you're going. Stepping behind the counter, the girl watched her mother pick up the tub of goods.
You're the one that said nothing good ever comes from the Jundland wastes.
Hush, Annalene said, already to the exit. I'll be back before lunch. Callie's voice went up two octaves.
Tell Ben I said hello.
The whir of a land speeder sounded outside, and Ulbrich reappeared at the counter before Callie, continuing his winding tale. He didn't even seem to notice that he'd switched Cowwells.
Chapter 13.
If not for the sound, she would have driven past it. White on white under the climbing suns, the squarish hut with its poor stone dome neatly blended with the Jundland wastes. Only when Annalene banked the X-31 along the desert floor did she see the glint from the vaporator out back. The hut squatted low on a southwestern bluff. Likely, she figured, situated over a cave. Another last-ditch lodge. The term was fully pejorative, referring to frontier dwellings built on the theory, never proven, that the uplands of the wastes yielded more condensation at night. No one knew for sure, because even the hardiest farmers seldom lasted more than a season. These were places for grubbers on their last chance, and would-be wizards who just knew they had magical combinations of vaporator settings no one had ever thought of before. The whole thing was ludicrous to Annalene. Assuming anyone hit it lucky, what investor in his right mind would build an industrial farm out here? Crazy. She wasn't crazy, though, to pick this direction. Annalene had seen Ben head out from the oasis days earlier, and Orin had reported meeting him out this way. After the past airless week, a hint of a trail still existed. Now she spotted Ben's Yopi quivering out front, less worried about her approach than the noise from out back. Annalene parked the speeder and reached into the rumble seat. That had been an invention of Danar's, ripping out the back of the middle console to make room for the younglings, or in this case, Ben's tub of supplies. Realizing what the sound was, she suppressed a laugh as she walked the goods up the hill.
All right, Ben called out from behind the house. I take your meaning. You're upset. You can stop now.
A mountain of hair, easily his match for height, backed up and charged again, horns first, into the side of Ben's hut. Annalene propped the tub on her hip and watched with a barely concealed smile. having a problem with your bantha?
No, no. Why do you ask?
Ben gripped a rope and tried to get the calf's attention. He'd been at this a while, Annalene saw. His blousy white shirt was dingy, and sweat dripped from dark blonde hair exposed to the sky. The animal snorted angrily and returned to its mission. She pointed to the rope.
What are you planning to do with that?
I'm considering hanging myself. He looked up at her, exasperated.
I don't know what I did to set it off.
Normally, I'm good with animals.
Well, as you saw with Callie the other day, they're still animals, she said, setting down the tub.
Forget the rope. Let me have a try. He gestured indifferently.
Be my guest.
Annalene removed her gloves and strolled toward the massive creature. Raising animals isn't like raising teenagers. Kids don't know what they want, and they want it now. Animals, on the other hand, usually do know what they want. Like this guy, she said, edging toward the bantha calf.
He thinks your house is his mother.
His mother?
Yep.
Feeling the steaming breath of the wild behemoth, Annalene reached out gently and touched the calf's face. The bantha stamped its feet impatiently.
Mama's probably wandered farther up into the wastes. He can't find her.
If you had this much hair over your face, you might lose your way, too.
To a bantha calf, everything that's bigger than food is probably mom. A good rule of thumb.
Ben crossed his arms and watched with concern as Annalene inserted herself fully between the animal and the battered wall.
What do I do?
Shh. Annalene traced the calf's eye sockets with her fingers. Leaning forward, she nuzzled its face. The bantha's hooves stilled. The woman whispered to Ben,
"You are going to watch me point him somewhere else."
Ben stood back as Annalene strode forward, pushing the young bantha by the horns. It outweighed her by a metric ton at least, and yet it was backing down the hill. At the foot of the bluff, she turned it to one side and gave it a swat. Long, shaggy hair swaying, it moseyed off.
"Won't he die out there?"
"Nah." Annalene pulled a handkerchief from inside her boot and rubbed her hands.
"He won't be alone that long.
If he doesn't find his herd, he'll find a Tuscan to adopt," she said. Ben nodded.
"My house thanks you. I did try, well, to calm it." "It's all right. You were probably its first human."
Annalene caught a trace of a smile before the man turned and started back up the hill to his house. Ben's expressions in the store had been happier, she thought. Here, he seemed a little downcast.
"It must be depressing, living alone so far out here."
He looked back at her.
"Why are you here, Annalene?"
"Special delivery."
Walking with him, she pointed to the tub of goods.
"Most of our thieves take things without paying. You're the only person I've met who paid and left his stuff." "I'm a very poor thief, then."
Ben moved the bin into the dubious shade of the vaporator. He scratched his head.
"I'm sorry for the trouble of the other day. I hope there weren't any damages. I should be apologizing to you." "It's a friendlier store than that," she said. "When I didn't see you again, I was afraid they'd scared you off."
"Ah." Ben looked around.
"No, I've been busy."
To Annalene, this side of the house looked like bazaar day for the Jawas. Lots of gear sitting around and gathering sand. And while the doorway to the house was here, the door was not. The burlap curtain she'd sold him hung across the entrance.
"The former residents left me with a work in progress," Ben said.
"A while ago, it looks like."
"Yes. I'd thought to build my own home, but that's more involved than I'd expected," he said.
"But there seems to be no shortage of abandoned buildings."
"You should at least get a door."
Ben looked amused.
"Are you trying to sell me something else?"
just afraid you're going to freeze at night. A lot of this stuff needs to be inside, in fact. She walked toward the EOP pen. And you need to get a